Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are the mysteries, charms, and frustrations of life in Haiti so challenging for foreigners to fully comprehend? And how does that gap in understanding relate to a long history of failed outsider attempts to rescue Haiti from its most persistent problems? American journalist Amy Willens lived in Haiti for 2 years and has been making regular visits for more than 25. In that time, she's come to feel great affection for Haiti and its people, and to see the country as far more than the sum of its exotic reputation or its many struggles, even in the wake of the devastating earthquake of 2010. Amy Willens teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine. Her new book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Amy, welcome to Think.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Talk about why you have been so drawn to Haiti over the years and why you were interested in it before you had ever been there.
Well, I got interested in it because I was I learned French in elementary school and in high school, so I spoke French, and then, and that's the imperialist language down in Haiti, mm-hmm. the language of colonialism. And then I was living in Manhattan, and I was living in this neighborhood where there were a lot of Haitian refugees from Duvalier, and they had a lot of newspapers written in French and in Creole, and I started reading their newspapers. And I found that the dictator, Baby Doc Duvalier, was about to fall from reading their newspapers. I could see I was entering into a soap opera that was coming to a conclusion, but I didn't really understand what was happening. I just saw that that was a possibility. And meanwhile, I'd read Graham Greene's The Comedians, which is his great, wonderful novel about Papa Doc Duvalier, who preceded his son in power and was a very bloody-minded dictator. So all of these things combined to make me think, I should go down to Haiti. And I was really just at the very beginning of my career as a journalist. And I thought, this is just such a great story. And I don't want to miss it. I don't want to miss the fall of the dictator. More important, I didn't want to miss seeing Haiti while it was under the Duvaliers. So I rushed down, and I got there 5 days before, you know, thinking myself so original. 5 days before Duvalier fell, the entire international press corps was down there a few days after I arrived, all those who weren't following the fall of Marcos in the Philippines. And that was my baptism by fire, and it was a truly incredible thing to see and watch.
So much of this book takes on the skewed stereotypes and expectations of outsiders who fail to fully understand Haiti, even when they mean well. What did it take for you to feel confident that you did understand it, and how much did that relate to your ability to fully communicate in Creole?
Oh, Chris, I don't think I fully understand it. And anyone who's listening who thinks they fully understand Haiti, Haitian or outsider, is probably wrong. But I did learn Creole, and I started to learn Creole before I went down to Haiti. I heard it on the streets, you know, and it's very closely related to French. So I could understand a large portion of the vocabulary, but it was the speaking and the grammar that was hard. But I got these tapes from the University of Indiana, and so I had learned a little bit of Creole before I even got there. And that was hugely helpful because it is a little bit of an impenetrable culture, especially without the language.
Is there a sense when you are at least able to understand basically what's being said in Creole that you are more to be trusted than someone who comes speaking only French, for example?
Yes, you're more to be trusted by normal people. Like if you're sitting around in the shanty towns and talking to people and you can understand them and they can basically understand you, that's great, and they feel much more comfortable. But, of course, naturally, otherwise it's like dealing with a deaf and dumb person who can't even speak sign language in my case. So, but with people who are, say, a little bit more sophisticated than the average shantytown dweller, they may be suspicious of you because you speak Creole. They may think you're some kind of a weird spy or something. So I had that a lot, especially back in the early days when there were spies.
Let's talk about this phrase in your title, Fred Voodoo. This is a term that was sometimes used informally by foreign journalists to describe the people one spoke to for these man-on-the-street interviews. What did it signify exactly, and what makes it so emblematic of the kind of misunderstanding that tends to color foreign journalism about Haiti?
Well, it's like for those foreign journalists back then who were much less shy about being politically incorrect. what it was to put everybody under the same rubric. It's insulting, like Joe Sixpack, implying that every American is a beer drinking yahoo. You know, this implies that every Haitian is, because of the use of the term voodoo rather than the real name of the religion that Haitians pursue, which is called vodou. Fred Voodoo. It implies that they're all, you know, superstitious and into black magic, possibly cannibals. All these really ridiculous, outre, exotic phenomena that the white man has somehow attached to vodou, and it is not like that at all.
What does it take to build an understanding of what vodou actually is in order to understand Haitian culture when you are not a practitioner yourself?
You know, it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
Because, first of all, you go to a vodou ceremony, and you are an outsider, and they look at you, you're an outsider, you're watching, you know, you're not, and it's such a participatory religion. You're right in it. If you're a practitioner, you can become the god,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I shy away in a serious fashion from becoming, you know, one of these outsiders who's so into vodou that they become actual practitioners and get, you know, recognized as such. Because I think they lose perspective, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you're inside it. So as a journalist, you don't want to do that. I think the thing is to see as much of it as possible and to learn as much of it. I mean, a ton has been written on vodou by outsiders, by practitioners, you know, more sophisticated practitioners, not country people. And I think you can learn a lot by reading it. I learned a ton by reading it, and it's just so fascinating, and it's so original. And when I say original, I don't mean it's idiosyncratic. I mean it's so close to being like the first religion I really learned about, which was Greek mythology and the Greek pantheon. That's what it really reminds me of, the foundational religion of, in a sense, our culture.
Why do you think it's been so misinterpreted? I can't speak for other countries, but the way that Americans see this thing that we pronounce voodoo sounds to be very skewed from the real thing.
Well, I think it's because it was the religion of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
So you brought over people to work for you as slaves, and everyone knew it was wrong. Let's be honest. You know, read Uncle Tom's Cabin for a half a second. You know that everyone knew it was wrong, always. So you had these human beings in conditions, direst conditions of enslavement. This was their religion. This was, you know, this fabulous thing they could resort to. On Sundays, in at least in Haiti, the plantation owners used to let the slaves go off and have what they called, you know, Sunday parties to let off steam. But these were voodoo ceremonies, and largely voodoo ceremonies. And they did indeed blow off steam, a lot of steam. But it frightened the masters because it was a way to have solidarity among the slaves, and solidarity among slaves, especially in a place like Haiti where slaves outnumbered masters 10-1, was a dangerous thing. And so therefore, you know, they would let them have their parties, but they would not allow them to worship in the way they had normally worshipped in Africa. So they had to hide all the gods of vodou behind the saints of the Catholic Church, so that you'll have Saint Jacques will be actually the African god Ogun, but you know he was masked. It's called syncretism.
You write that there is barely a moment in all Haitian history that has no relation to the United States. Talk about that shared history and why it has so often been to Haiti's detriment.
Well, let's start with the Haitian Revolution that began in 1791,
mm-hmm.
and ended with independence in 1804. So here you have a country a little less, I think, than 500 miles off the United States coast, accessible by boat at the time, where the slave population has thrown off the masters and asserted its right to be fully human and to be self-governing. This was not received, this message was not received with pleasure by the still slaveholding United States. And we reacted by non-recognition, we reacted by trade embargoes. France, which was the country actually cast off by the slaves, reacted by demanding reparations from Haiti in order for Haiti to be allowed to enter into the world economy, which Haiti paid. Essentially, the Haitian slaves, now free, were paying the masters back for their free selves. So there was that. And then further with the United States, finally recognition came in 1867. You'll note that's after the Civil War ended and the slaves were freed in the United States. And then by the beginning of the 1900s, again, we were involved in Haiti in a very detrimental way, which was that we came in and took over and made Haiti safe for Citibank and other places, to quote, other companies, to quote one of the Marines who helped. And so we, and then we stayed there from 1915 to 1934, and this created a gigantic backlash among Haitians and a kind of a rebel movement, which eventually succeeded, along with American public opinion, in ending the Marine occupation of Haiti. And since then, it's continued on and on, with us interfering in their elections, with us green-lighting coup d'etats, and with us, you know, just now since the earthquake, really coming in and forming a sort of occupation. Actually, since the overthrow, the second overthrow of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004.
You write about your really complex history with Aristide. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, you know, he was a great hero to me. And he was a parish priest when I first got to Haiti, just after the Duvaliers fell. He had been speaking out against the Duvaliers, this tiny little stick of a man, from long before the fall of the Duvaliers, long before I got there. So I went to him, and I met him, and I was just amazed by him and his bravery. He was a truly outstanding orator. And I always would say to him, as he was becoming more and more popular among Haitians, I would say, you know, I would rather visit you in the National Penitentiary than in the National Palace, which is where the president lives in Haiti. And he would laugh at me, and, you know, I was so romantic, and he was not romantic, it later turned out, because he ran for president that very year, and he became president in 1990 in the first election in which a Haitian president was freely and fairly elected. So that was a very important thing. But then he couldn't rise to the occasion of his presidency. I don't know if this was character flaws or the incredible pressures under which Haitian presidents operate from the outside and the inside. But in any case, his presidency was very difficult from the beginning, and then he was very quickly ousted before he had been in office for a year. So that was terrible. And then more of United States mixing in with Haitian politics, the Americans brought him back. So he was ousted under Bush Sr., or as we like to call him in Haiti, Papa Bush. Then he was brought back in to Haiti by President Clinton in what I think is the only instance of regime change by the United States in which we implant an ousted leader. And then he was ousted again under Baby Bush. So there you have more American involvement.
And the rule in Haiti is that one can hold the presidency twice, but not consecutively,
exactly.
Even under ideal circumstances.
Exactly, to avoid the development of a cult of personality the way there was under François Duvalier, Papa Doc.
Amy Willens is with us. She's a journalist and author who teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine. We're talking about her new book, Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Amy Willits. She is a journalist and author who teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at UC Irvine. Her new book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Amy, you write that you initially resisted returning to Haiti immediately following the earthquake of 2010. Before we talk about why you couldn't stay away, can you describe for us your emotional reaction upon learning the news that this place that you've come to care so deeply about, that has people in it that you care so deeply about, had been affected like this?
Well, first of all, I remember after Katrina, I wrote to a friend of mine who is a novelist who was from New Orleans and wrote about New Orleans, and I said, I just can't even begin to understand how you must feel having your place destroyed. So that was one of the things I felt. I thought, oh, now I know how Nancy felt.
Yeah.
But so that was very disturbing. Of course, I was in my car coming home from Irvine to L.A., and my husband called me and told me there'd been a big earthquake. We didn't even really know what it was at first, but I was terribly worried about my friends, and I wrote a quick thing for the Huffington Post about my friend who I couldn't reach, and ever since he's been very pleased to note that I had written his obituary before, a little prematurely. But I was very worried, and I was horrified to think that all these places that I had spent so much time in might be gone, and indeed, almost all of them were. Hmm. The cathedral, the palace, you know, all these places, museums.
The palace is an interesting place, and it's a place that was ultimately built with foreign help and then raised with foreign help.
Exactly. It was built by the Marines, according to the plan of a Haitian architect, at least. Thank you. And it was really beautiful. But, of course, it was very fraught for me as a place because I'd visited Aristide there, sure, but I'd also interviewed, you know, various leaders of military juntas and various dictators. So it was kind of, you didn't love the palace until the palace was falling down, and then you sort of started to realize, well, it's still the White House. They even call it the White House in mm-hmm. Haiti. And it was standing there like three, you know, it was a tri-domed building, and it was standing there like three drunks leaning up against each other, you know, after the earthquake. And no one took it down. And someone said to me, well, every beggar needs his stump, when I asked, some Haitian said that to me, when I asked why they weren't taking it down after the earthquake. And then finally, Sean Penn, with his usual energetic decision-making and gigantic capacity to get people together, got people together, and they took down the palace.
Why did you initially not want to go back?
Well, first of all, I think that catastrophes tend to equalize things and make everything like every other thing. You're just a victim of catastrophe. So I didn't want to see Haiti reduced to just being like, you know, Managua after the earthquake or Ashe, is that how you pronounce it, after the tsunami. I wanted Haiti to be the way I knew Haiti to be. So I knew that was going to be very hard for me. And then I have this tendency to try to adopt journalistic distance, and I felt that I was going to, if I experienced sympathy fatigue while going through the earthquake, that I would really have to hate myself. So I was worried about that, too. I was worried about me, I was worried about them, and I was worried about Haiti.
Hmm. It's so interesting when you sort of write about Haitians' perception of things were so horrible, and yet there was also a sense that in some quarters that maybe inflating the numbers of people who had been killed would be an opportunity for an influx of foreign money. Can you talk a little bit about the official response by the Haitian government to the earthquake?
Well, it was really, really sad in certain ways. I mean, it was in a sense it was evil, but also it was sad. President Préval, who was the president at the time of the earthquake, had been, I think he was the best president I saw in Haiti, and he wasn't very good, but he was really trying to inch forward, and I think he was putting things together in an intelligent, perhaps overly crafty way, but he was doing stuff for Haiti. And then the earthquake came, and he was totally unable to respond, and has said so. He was where we needed a Churchill, you know, somebody to rally the Haitian people and get people working and clearing and put them back on their feet again, at least emotionally, mm-hmm. he disappeared. He was voiceless. And he said afterward that he didn't want to, you know, be seen in front of crumbled down houses and babies with one arm, you know, rattling on about himself in some way. He thought it would be kind of profiteering. But yeah, let me talk a little bit about why you want more dead bodies in a situation like that. I mean, if you imagine that this is a terribly, terribly poor country in which the average Haitian doesn't make more than $375 a year, then you got to think that whenever someone sees an opportunity to make money, they're going to try to make money. And this was a giant, giant opportunity to have money flowing into Haiti. And so, and if it had been 6,000 people killed, that would have been bad, and we all would have been really upset, I think, in America. Mm-hmm. But when it's 300,000 people killed, then you're just shocked by it, and you can't help but rush off to PayPal, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. And the 300 is a largely artistic number, but it's not, I think, over time. I mean, when I was writing the book, I had different sources. Now I think the acknowledged figure is like at 217,000, but I'm not really sure that that's any more scientific than the original 316,000. You know, 100,000 Haitians here or there, who will notice? It's
yeah.
the kind of feeling.
I mean, the profound nature of a statement like that is really
exactly.
Horrifying.
Yeah.
The unemployment rate is another thing that officially it's like 50%.
Your sense? I saw that today, 52%. What are they talking about?
What have you seen?
Well, I mean, if you think of unemployment as a person who's lying down on his bed because he doesn't have a job, then, it's probably, that's 52% of patients. I just don't even understand it. If you, anecdotally, the rate is about 85%. And that's if we're talking about real jobs. Now, Haitians are working every day. You have never seen a people more industrious. Some Haitian once said, Haitians work hard all the time, but they never seem to get anything done. And that's because the economy is so terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you do whatever little job you can do. You're out there all day long trying to make ends meet. And when I say make ends meet, I mean make like about $7 a day if you can, so that you can not just feed yourself but feed a child or two.
Amy, why is the economy so terrible? I mean, we know at least that for some time, using slave labor, and that may be the reason, the French were able to make a great deal of money with their agriculture in Haiti. Why why does the country struggle so to bring in money now?
Well, the French made a lot of money with slave plantation labor, right? That
mm-hmm.
was a fantastic system for extracting money from an agricultural process.
Yeah.
But the sugar didn't go back to Haiti, the profits didn't go back to Haiti, everything went to the French and to the European market. So there was that. Now Haiti's globalized in a different way. Instead of producing everything for the world, all the sugar in the world, instead it imports everything. It imports, most notably, the example of Miami rice. So that was rice coming out through the port of Miami into Haiti in the late 80s and early 90s. Papadoc had kept a strict, tight control on rice, and it could only come in through Port-au-Prince and had to pay steep tariffs to him, basically extortionist tariffs to him, so rice didn't come in, which meant that essentially the Haitian rice cultivators were protected under the Duvaliers. But then once the Duvaliers fell, all the ports opened, and surplus taxpayer-subsidized American rice started pouring into the Haitian markets, underselling Haitian rice. So that put the cultivators out of business and effectively destroyed a large portion of Haitian agriculture, and indeed caused a lot of people to migrate to Port-au-Prince, where they were sitting there like ducks, you know, lined up for the earthquake to kill. So there are so many repercussions of things that happen. But Haiti is a really globalized country without a national financial policy, economic policy, so that what happens is it gets kind of creamed by all the stuff coming in, but it doesn't have a policy for what it's going to send out. And now they have one big South Korean garment factory in the north where some Haitians are employed, a couple of thousand. And it's in an industrial park where supposedly 60,000 Haitians will be employed. And so that's been the international community's response to creating a viable economy for Haiti. I'm not that into it.
What's the total population right now, Amy?
I think it's like 9 million. Mm-hmm. It might be 10 million. I'm not really sure. A million Haitians here or there. No, I don't mean that, of course.
I know. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak on the phone with Don in Richardson. Hi, Don.
Hi. My question has to do with the Marine that your guest mentioned. I know when she alluded to the fact, I think, that Marines a lot of times were sent into places like Haiti in order to benefit Citibank and other banks. And I'm wondering if the Marine that she was alluding to was Smedley Darlington Butler. He was a major general Marine commander who wrote a little book called War is a Racket.
That's exactly who I'm speaking of. Smedley Butler. That's the man.
Tell us a little bit more about him.
Well, he was a really interesting figure because he led, not only in Haiti, but in other places in Latin America, he led various Marine incursions. And then he kind of turned coat on the Marines intellectually and politically and started writing about what he felt his mission had really been, which was not to to pacify Haiti, but rather to make it safe for various U.S. corporate interests.
Why is there such a brain drain from Haiti for the small segment of the population that is able to obtain a decent education?
Well, first of all, a lot of the brain drain began under the Duvaliers, and that's because the Duvaliers went after the brains.
Right. They were killing people.
They didn't want that kind of opposition. They didn't want the intellectual class running rebellions. So they pretty much went after the intellectual elite, and a lot of people left then. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of Haiti's educated people were light-skinned from the mulatto class, and Papa Doc also made a kind of war against the elite for a good part of his time in office. So those people also left. So you had the people who had access to education leaving the country. But there are other good reasons to leave Haiti if you have an education, like what job are you going to do? So there's that, you know, how much of a future is there for, say, someone like me in Haiti if I were a Haitian? I'm not sure what I would do. You have to be a kind of a patriot to remain if you have the option to leave. So I really admire all those people who stay. Now, a lot of people stay who are brilliant and fabulous, but they can't get a visa. A lot of people stay who aren't that educated but are brilliant and fabulous because they don't know what's available to them and can't get out. But most people who can get out do, and those are largely people with connections and education. Then there's the other question about the earthquake, which is, so there were some remaining, of course, fabulous, brilliant, talented people remaining in Haiti when the earthquake struck, and a lot of those people left jobs in Haitian firms and Haitian businesses to go for more lucrative jobs with the reconstruction wave of reconstruction groups that came in. So Haiti lost a lot of people that way, and those people now have development resumes and possibly easier ways to get out of the country.
You write here about a lot of concerns with the foreign aid industry, and I use the word industry very deliberately in Haiti, even when it involves people who want to do the right thing. And it seems one mistake that foreigners make in assuming they can fix Haiti by making it more like wherever they came from.
Yeah, well, I think it's not quite so much that. They would like to make it more like here, right? And why wouldn't they? And Haitians would like that a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to transform a country that has so many structural problems in 3 years after a giant catastrophe from Haiti into, say, L.A., right? That's not easy. So there's that problem. And then the other problems are that a country like this is, you know, not even a country like Haiti, but say it were France, and we came in and wanted to make France just like America. Well, we wouldn't be able to do it because French people have been living with their culture, their history, their art, their traditions for hundreds and even thousands of years. And Haitians similarly have their own culture, their own ways of doing things. And you can't just simply have this blank slate of development and impose it on a country. You just can't do it. You can't come in and say, you know what, Haitians, there's a lot of calcium in the leaves of this tree we're bringing into your country, so eat those and you'll get your calcium. It's like if they came to my house and told me to do that, I would say, well, I'm glad your tree has calcium, but my boys like to drink milk.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to go out and try and find some milk for my boys because that's how they like their Oreos, not with leaves. And that's kind of what happens with development. There's a constant imposition of the outsider's view of how you could be helped. And then when you are not helped by their plan for you, you're seen in Haiti as somehow lacking, as somehow backward, as somehow completely wrong. Yet you can see with the thought experiment of them coming to your house, there's nothing wrong with the Haitians. They just have their own tradition and culture.
Why is it so hard for aid groups, aid workers to sort of be on the ground for a while and observe the way things are done and accommodate their methods to Haitian culture?
Well, I just really think there was a lot of racism in the development community as it was coming into Haiti because there was so much fear. I mean, the first things that you heard after the earthquake was, we have to pacify them. You know, something like 65% of U.S. relief aid to Haiti went back straight back to the Defense Department to send in troops so that Haitians wouldn't, you know, riot and kill the elite or burn down, I don't know, oil tankers or something. I don't even know what they were thinking, except they were very concerned about looting, you know. So there was a lot of racism in that way, and that played out in the reconstruction community in very ugly and not useful ways, like gated communities and red zones where the development workers were not allowed to go, and cluster groups that didn't include any Haitians. And you ended up living what Ron Garrity called the compound life. So that you went from your compound to a fancy restaurant for dinner that was in the green zone, and you hung out with your people and some elite Haitians, and you never got to know the people who you were fixing.
Amy Willens is with us. We're talking about her new book, Farewell Fred Voodoo. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Amy Willens. She teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine, and she is the author of a new book called Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Amy, what is the healthcare system, if we can use that word, like in Haiti?
Well, it's fractured and it's centralized. So if you're out in the countryside and you have a problem, you have to travel a long distance to find a doctor. And then that doctor, well, I can't really vouch for him most of the time. There is Partners in Health, which is an outsider group but has really planted Haitian roots, and they've been there for almost as long as I've been going to Haiti, and I really respect them for the work they've done in Haiti, especially pre-earthquakes, and they've put clinics in a lot of places that didn't have clinics before. But in town, there's the National Hospital, the state hospital of Haiti, and before the earthquake, it was really it was unacceptable. I remember when I would go there and there would be two or three people to a bed and there's no food. You have to bring your own food, which probably the Haitian patients like better as long as they have somebody to bring them food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the healthcare itself wasn't great. There's not a lot of infrastructure for healthcare, so the kinds of cardiac or oncological equipment that you would expect in, say, a New York hospital is not available there. There's no kind of Cedars-Sinai, Mount Sinai hospital there. And since the earthquake, there have been other problems because there were a few private clinics that had some good equipment and well-trained doctors, but they had a very difficult time when all these well-trained foreign doctors came rushing in for the earthquake and stayed on and gave out free care because they were subsidized. And so these private clinics went under. Many of them were bankrupted during the time after the earthquake because all their patients turned away and went to the American doctors or the French doctors.
So again, there's those
Haiti
unintended...
Haiti is the land of unintended consequences.
Yeah. You write about one American doctor, I think she's from New Jersey, and,
yes.
and not only does she do some really great work, but it seems like somehow she was able to leap in, understand the needs, like the specific needs of her patients on their own terms, including the issue of being fed every day.
Yeah. Well, she noticed that her name is Megan Coffey, and I don't want to make her into this grand hero. She's just a great, humble, normal, matter-of-fact person with a lot of staying power. And she noticed that her patients were sometimes hungry, and she realized some of them weren't getting fed. A lot of them had their moms there or their sisters or their uncles, but some of them didn't really have anybody, and or the food supplied wasn't good enough, wasn't feeding them enough calories. So she started to cook for them. So she'd get up in the morning, she'd put a pot of water to boil on the stove, she'd go take her shower, after throwing some spaghetti in there. When her shower was finished, the spaghetti was finished. And I'm not saying a bowl of spaghetti. I'm saying a huge trash bag full of spaghetti. And that is how the spaghetti was transported by Dr. Coffey. She put it in a giant trash bag. She put the trash bag in a box. And she brought it to her ward in the general hospital, the one I was just describing, where she had established a kind of ad hoc tuberculosis ward. She's a specialist in infectious diseases, which is very important in Haiti. So she brought in her spaghetti every morning to the ward, and then she would make sauce for it. And the sauce was made of, I swear, earthquake relief ketchup and earthquake relief mayonnaise that she has in these huge vats at the clinic she had then. And she would mix the two and dump it on the spaghetti, and those patients were as happy as clams. I watched this food distribution several times. Eventually, however, I will say they got sick of it, and she had to start buying hot dogs for them.
It is funny, though, when she essentially early on was saying, look, this is what they like. It's getting some nourishment into them, and it's something that I'm able to do.
Right, and I can do it, and they like it, and it makes them laugh, you know, in conditions where you wouldn't really be laughing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone to David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi. Great show, as always. I have a question having to do more with geography, and maybe the guest can kind of address this. Haiti is on the Isle of Hispaniola, if I understand correctly, and right next door to them is the Dominican Republic. How did those two become separate countries on an island that has such a shared history, and why is it Haiti just seems to always have the worst end of it? Because you never really hear about anything bad going on in the Dominican Republic, unless it's a hurricane hitting or some catastrophe like that. When this catastrophe hit a few years back, I don't remember hearing anything, one word being mentioned about the Dominican Republic. Why is there such a separation between the two?
Well, let's first talk about geography and the earthquake. So the earthquake didn't touch the Dominican Republic. So that's why you didn't hear about the earthquake in the Dominican Republic. I mean, they felt it, but it didn't damage anything, and it didn't extend over the border. That wasn't the way the fault is shaped. And there have been repeated earthquakes in Port-au-Prince, by the way, over history. There was one 100 years ago that was very serious also. But now let's go further. Okay, so they have this divided history because there were many colonial powers operating in on Hispaniola, or the island that the two countries share. And one of those powers was the Spanish, and eventually the Spanish prevailed on the Dominican side and the French prevailed on the Haitian side. Then there was the Haitian Revolution. The Haitians took over the whole island in the 1840s for, I think, 20 years. So once they left the Dominican Republic, there's a terrible enmity between the two countries, an underlying enmity. It's kind of been masked by the earthquake, but there it still exists. And it's also partly racialized. The Dominicans, think that they're not black and that the Haitians are black. And then along the border, there are sugar plantations on the Dominican side run by a parastatal, that is to say half state, half private group. And on these sugar plantations, Haitians work as slaves. I know because I did a human rights report on modern slavery in the Dominican Republic, and I interviewed a lot of the Haitians who live in slave quarters and work on the plantations as cane cutters. So there's that kind of thing. But, you know, I happen to really dislike this question always, and I'm sorry to say this, and I don't mean this about this particular caller, but often there is a subtle racism at play underneath which says, you know, Haitians are black, and that's why their country is more screwed up than the Dominican side. And I say, no, Haitians have one history, and the Dominicans have another, and that's why the Haitians are screwed up. And it all comes back to that premature revolution, which was so glorious, so incredible, so violent, so destructive, and was way too early for the rest of the world to accept.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Johnny in Plano. Hey, Johnny.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would like to ask the journalist, doesn't she think that it's a little bit unfair for the NGOs that went back to Haiti after the earthquake, and then they were still dealing with the same people that held Haiti in slavery, like the small portion of the people who have money in Haiti, and they're still dealing with those people?
Yes, I do think it's unfair, and it was really bad. And in some cases, it was very, very corrupt. For instance, there was, you know, everybody was looking for ways to build temporary and permanent new housing for Haitians affected by the earthquake. So in one case, and they had to figure out a place to put these new shelters. So they had to find land. And land at the land surrounding Port-au-Prince is owned by some very questionable members of the elite aristocracy who've been, I think that our caller would probably agree, ripping off the Haitian people for, you know, 75 to 150 years. So anyway, one of these plots of land was owned by one of these families, and they were part of a cartel that has a bad meaning now, but it just means a group of businesses, a cartel together that included someone who was a consultant to the government, and somehow he managed to get the government to buy this land from the people in his cartel for $7 million to put these houses on. So basically the earthquake was like a real estate broker for the morally repugnant elite in that case, and that was really unacceptable. And a lot of the times, just as the marine occupation from 1915 to 1934 worked almost exclusively with the elite and the lighter-skinned Haitians and the richer Haitians and the more educated Haitians, so too did the Reconstruction effort.
Will you talk a little bit about the effect of poverty tourism, which you call poorism in the book, and what motivates it, and how, for one thing, how it makes Haitians feel?
Well, I worry about this a lot because I feel like that's half my job is kind of a professionalized poverty tourism. You know, I go into shanty towns, and there I am. So I go in there, and I think, this is so cool. I'm sitting here. These people are so nice. They're sharing their limited stuff with me, and they like me, and mm-hmm. I like them. Okay, maybe all of that is true superficially, but what's really happening, to my mind, when I'm self-critical afterwards, is I've gone into a place where I would never be allowed to go in the first world. Can you imagine if I just came up to you and said, hi, I'd like to come in and look at your house. Could mm-hmm. I have some of your food?
Yeah.
It doesn't happen. And you have to always be prepared to do that thought experiment to see what you're really doing in Haiti. So I always feel that I'm intruding and that they look at me as a visitor from another planet, which I really appear to be to them. And that they wonder what could be my reasons for being there and what will they get out of it. And I I worry about that a lot, too. Like, I come in, I write about them, I write about their earthquake, I come home, I publish this, I get fame, I get some money, not much, I will add, but I get some money for writing about it, and they get what we say in Yiddish is bupkis, right? They get nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, I feel it's a very exploitive relationship, even with me, who means not to exploit them, but merely to show their reality. And so others who come in like that, who knows what they're doing, you know, who want to take a little tour of the slums or something. It doesn't happen that much in Haiti because Haiti has been so demonized recently. But it does happen elsewhere. So, but on the other hand, I wish that the reconstruction organizations would spend more time doing pourism just so they would know who they're dealing with. And I don't really care that much about what the Haitians might think of them.
You know, Amy, you have one account in the book that I didn't find was at all exploitative, and maybe that reflects my own biases, but you talk about being sort of caught in a storm, and then you meet this family that you had known before, and they invite you in and offer to share with you their just incredibly meager meal. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened that night?
Well, I was supposed to meet some young men in the in one of the refugee camps in the middle of Port-au-Prince, but they didn't show up. You know, sometimes they showed up, sometimes they didn't. And then a huge downpour began, and I was wearing my ridiculous-looking poncho, and I'm, of course, the only white person there and the only grown-up stupid enough to be out in the rain. Lots of little kids are going all over the place, but no grown-ups. And I thought, well, maybe I'll find these other people who I know in the camp. So, of course, I'm looking and looking and looking for them. And then a woman beckons to me from underneath this tiny little awning that she's constructed outside her tent where she's cooking dinner. And she beckons to me, and I come over. And, of course, it's the woman I'm looking for because that's the way Haiti is.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I think in the way I describe it in the book is really accurate. It's terribly poor. They're living in basically a fixed-up tent that's as big as your closet, you know, as big as a California king-size bed. And I go in there, and yet, because they're them and they care and it's their family, it was kind of cozy and warm with the rain pouring outside and it wasn't leaking in there yet. And they were cooking dinner on this little tiny stove, this little tiny dinner. And then they offered me their only spoon to share with them this little meal that actually looked very, very good. It was sardines and onions and a tomato sauce on a pile of rice, and I really wanted to eat it, but then I thought, look, that there are four of them, one, two, three, four, five of them. There was a little baby, too, who was sick, and then there's me. I'm going to eat later. I can eat whatever I want, so I had to say no, which is impolite, but I felt like, a Goldilocks intruding in the house of the three bears.
Journalist Amy Willents teaches in the Literary Journalism Program at UC Irvine. Her new book is called Farewell, Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. Amy, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.